I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Today, my conversation with Stephen King from Writers on a New England Stage. In addition to On Writing, King has written several books, The Shining, The Dark Half, Bag of Bones, and Misery, about writers frustrated by writing, struggling for literary credibility, or writing under compulsion. Another writer, James Parker, suggests put them together and you have a wonderful diagram of King's imaginative process. Well, of course, many of those books have been made into films by noted directors. Brian De Palma adapted King's first novel, Carrie. Stanley Kubrick directed The Shining. We'll hear King's opinion of that film in just a moment. Other critical favorites are The Shawshank Redemption.
I guess it comes down to a simple choice, really. Get busy living, or get busy dying.
And Misery, starring James Caan and Kathy Bates, who won an Oscar in the role of an obsessive fan.
There is nothing to worry about. You're going to be just fine. I'll take good care of you. I'm your number one fan.
Stephen King himself has become an American icon in his own right and a common reference for pop culture parodies on programs like The Simpsons and Family Guy.
Well, what do you think, Marge? All I need is a title. I was thinking along the lines of no TV and no beer, make Homer something something.
Go crazy?
Don't mind if I do!
Oh my God, Stephen King! This would make a neat story. Done.
He was also parodied on Saturday Night Live. The skit depicted the prolific novelist furiously typing away while talking, eating a sandwich, and drinking. King played with his fame and reputation in the late 1970s and early 80s when he penned a handful of short novels under the pseudonym Richard Bachman, including Rage, The Running Man, and Thinner. He did so largely to measure for himself whether or not he could replicate his own success and allay at least part of the notion inside of his head that his popularity might all just be an accident of fate. But these books also sold well until a bookstore clerk discovered the ruse, and King then declared Bachman to be dead. We now return to my conversation with King on stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for the Writers on a New England Stage series. We took several questions from the audience, which I read off of cards, including this one. Having grown up in rural Maine, King's writing and characters capture the feeling of a certain aspect of Maine life. The question, what impact did being a native of Maine have on your development as a writer and the characters that you create?
It's so pervasive that I can't even begin to answer the question because it's in everything. It feels a little bit like scuba diving. Because I would never felt entirely at home in the environment. But having lived in Maine my whole life, one thing that happens is you get an ear that's tuned for the accent, and you can let go a lot of the artificial things that people write when they're from away, the New England accent. You know what it is, you hear it in your head, so it's natural.
You wrote in the book On Writing that I was built with a love of the night and the unquiet coffin.
Mm-hmm.
When or how did you first recognize that love?
I think, you know, my father left my mother when I was 2 years old, but he left a bunch of stuff behind in the attic. And my brother and I went in there, and we would look over the stuff that he had brought back from other parts of his existence. He was in the Merchant Marine, and there were China dolls, and there were postcards, there were pressed flowers, there were scrapbooks, and there was also a box of paperback books. And my brother grabbed a lot of the science fiction, and I found some stories by H.P. Lovecraft, mm-hmm. a book called The Lurker in the Tomb. It was an old Avon paperback reprint, and it had this green boogery thing coming out of a grave in the ground, and I thought, that's for me. Because, you know, here's the thing, all right? At some point in every interview that gets done on TV, because they're the real stoops of the industry, I mean, somebody will say, in a deceptively casual voice. So, what were you like as a kid? The implication is, what screwed you up to the point where you want to do this? You know, they're looking for that Freudian moment, you know, where you saw some awful thing, but I never did. I used to play baseball and hang out with my friends, and, you know, I was never ritually murdered cats or nailed flies to... You get certain equipment that's built in, and it's... I used to say it's like having a compass needle, and when it gets near whatever is your thing, it swings as if to true north. Mm. And that's true of all of us, whether it's guitar music or whether it's painting or something. You find what you're good at, and that's what blisses you out.
Well, you were stuck in bed for some time as a kid with what you call stripe throat.
Stripe throat,
Stripe throat. And your mother said to you, instead of transcribing all these other books, write one of your own. Mm-hmm. And you described an on-writing feeling like all this possibility came to you.
Yeah.
Do you still feel like that? Are there infinite possibilities in writing for you?
Totally. The only thing, the only limiting factor is time. I have a blast doing what I do. I mean, this is so good. People like me, people who write stories for a living, people who paint, people who play music, people who act. We're the most fortunate people. I'm sure that we have our flaws and we have our psychological wrinkles and things that are not so great. You know, Todd Rundgren, the rock guy, once did an album called The Ever-Popular Tortured Artist Effect. So, you know, we do have sort of a reputation for that. But I think it's like protective coloration, because it's like society says to you, you are our designated children. You go out on the playground, you play all the time, all you want, and we will watch you play and pay you so that we can watch you play. I mean, is that sick or what? It's so great. So, yeah, the short answer is I have a terrific time doing what I do.
And the only obvious follow-on question comes from Tom and Jenna. If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
That is such a loaded question. I guess I would like to be able to, I don't know. I wanted to say I'd like to be able to fly. But what if you lost that power at 38,000 feet? Like if kryptonite came or something like that, then you would be totally screwed. But if I say invisibility, immediately somebody thinks about, well, he's going to be hanging out in the girls' locker room. But as a writer, invisibility would be a great thing to have. Mm. You know, you could follow people's conversations. We're born snoops. X-ray vision would be cool.
Read that. You got a big audience. But you can still get that in the back of the comic books, I think. Those glasses.
Flame on. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, so more questions. Playing out in the playground is one thing, but
yep.
There is also, you know, a lot of kids take this stuff very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people take it very seriously. There are church groups, there are youth groups that say your books seduce kids into violence. And
mm-hmm.
a couple
mm-hmm.
cases, in 1997, a 14-year-old boy killed 3 young women, injured 5, and a copy of Rage, although it was by Richard Bachman, let's
yep.
note, was in his locker. Mark David Chapman. Read your books. In fact, there's a book out called Stephen King Killed John Lennon. Have you seen that?
Well, it's probably by this guy, Stephen Lightfoot.
Yeah, that's exactly
who also
it.
Believes that the USDA killed River Phoenix because he was a vegetarian. So, no.
Okay.
I don't want to say crazy, but that's it. No, I'm aware that we live in a violent society, and my view is that for most people, fiction of any kind is catharsis rather than an accelerant. That is that mm-hmm. people who read things are mostly able to use that imaginative facility to get past violent things in their own lives, the same way that people have a tendency to use horror fiction where the boogie monsters are are make-believe to deal with real problems in their real life. We have a tendency to see analogs between make-believe terrors and real ones. My view, and of course with the, in the case of Rage, the minute I saw that, I pulled that book from publication because I didn't want to be associated with anything like that. But you know what? In this world of ours, if you think of the consequences of everything that could happen, you know, you're afraid to make a move. And I see writing as an essentially courageous act and imagination as a way to speak out against all the forces of darkness. And nobody's going to shut me up. Simple as that.
Well, there's another kind of power that you have over readers. If we look at the 1987 novel Misery, which is probably something that comes up a lot for you. Annie Wilkes, Paul Sheldon's number one fan. This is another thing that's become a part of our lexicon because of Stephen King, number one fan, and Red Rum, of course. But anyway, she captured him.
You didn't do that right.
Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum.
You know, I tried from the master.
What can I say?
So, you know,
it's
you,
just part of my repertoire. I carry that guy. Kubrick film on my back like a safe. I never really liked it that much.
I know you never liked that film. Okay. That's
See,
what
thing,
we heard.
The thing about that is the book is about this guy who's trying to get sane and winds up at this hotel that drives him crazy. And in the movie, the first time you see Jack Nicholson, you know he's insane. There's nowhere to go from there. So... But anyway, yes, Misery.
Okay, wait. You know, let me just jump off that for a second because we have quite a few questions about movies. We just heard you didn't like Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of The Shining. You actually worked on a remake of another one many years later. Two related questions. What is your favorite movie adaptation of your
books? I'm easy to please. My mother used to say, "Stephen, if you were a girl, you'd always be pregnant." There's a certain amount of truth in that. For the scary ones, I love Cujo. I think Cujo is a terrific film. And that Dee Wallace, in A Fair World, Dee Wallace would have been nominated for an Academy Award. I like Stand By Me. I think that Rob Reiner did a terrific job with that. I gotta tell you a story while we're on this, and I'm watching the clock, not because I want to leave, but because I don't want to run my mouth runs away. My grandfather used to say, "Steve, your mouth falls open and all your guts come out." So, but I was in Florida and I was in the supermarket one day, and the deal that my wife and I have is she does the big shopping on Friday, and if there's something that needs in the middle of the week, I go. I push my cart around the corner, and there's this lady. It is Florida. The lady's about 116 years old. But her eyes are sharp. She looks at me and she says, "I know who you are. You're Stephen King. You write those scary things." "Well, you can write whatever you want, but I want you to know I don't respect what you do. I like movies that are uplifting. I like things like that Shawshank Redemption." this is a true story. So I said, "I wrote that." And she said, "No, you didn't." That's what happens when you're old, I guess. You get your way. So, but I like that one. I like The Green Mile and Misery.
This person Misery's loves good. The Dead Zone.
Pardon me? Dead Zone's a good one, too, good one.
And a related question. How come you haven't done any acting lately?
Well, because I suck at it. I like to act, and I have actually had some offers to do things. I think that, generally speaking, being from Maine, this is another thing you'll have to edit from the radio, but I have been typecast as the country asshole. Since I did Geordie Verrill and Creepshow, I was the guy who turned into a weed in Creepshow, and since then I get a lot of parts where you're, "God damn, what the hell is that thing?" You can see I do a good job at it, so I get offers.
Well, loads of people want to know when the Dark Tower series is going to be made into film.
I really don't know. J.J. Abrams was going to do it, And he's kind of pulled out of it. And there are some other things that might happen, probably will eventually. And all things come to those who wait. I have an idea for a novel that's set in Midworld that I want to write that comes between two of the outstanding the published Dark Tower books. Mm-hmm. So I think about going back there a lot. That's a safe place for me to go. I like it. I mean, you guys are out there, you guys who are Dark Tower fans, and I'm a Dark Tower fan. I love that place. There are other people who read some of my books who don't have an idea what we're talking about, but that's okay. That's what we do sometimes. That's how we roll.
Well, I believe, at this count, 80 films have been made of your work, probably something more than
that. I have no clue.
But you've...
But don't forget, Children of the Corn 1 through 9.
Okay,
I stand. I'm waiting
89.
For is, the one I'm waiting for is Children of the Corn Meet Leprechaun.
There could be a role in there for you, yes.
It's like that. It's like that thing about which superpower would you have. If the Children of the Corn did meet Leprechaun, who would win?
We're going to have to leave that one for later. But you sold more than 350 million books worldwide. One of the world's best-selling writers. And yet at one point you said you were the Big Mac and fries mm-hmm. of the literary world. Do you resent being labeled or having been labeled a writer for the masses rather than, you know, a great literary genius?
No, I mean, what I've always said when it comes to reading, I love good writing, and I also love good stories. And the ideal situation is when good writing and good stories exist together. That's the perfect combination. But I can read a story for story because the words, to my mind, the story is what comes first. That's the major thing. I want people to be taken away, and I want to be taken away myself when I read other people's stories. But I don't think there should be a barrier between popular fiction and literature. I was given an award, a National Book Award, about, I think, 7 or 8 years ago, and I mentioned a number of writers that had a lot of popular success that I thought were excellent writers that a lot of mainstream critics didn't read. And the woman who won the award for best novel that year said, we don't need Stephen King to give us a reading list. And I thought, but you do. You need somebody to give you a reading list so that you can get a wider view of what's going on in American fiction and get rid of these artificial distinctions. I don't think that... I don't think that either literature or popular fiction should be put in a ghetto, that one is a sort of country club literature for the mind and the other one is lower class or middle class. I think that we should all, you know, I'm an old hippie. I think, man, we should all live together.
Well, you have been able to, let's say, shapeshift from mm-hmm. From the perceived right to the masses into a very authoritative, prominent literary voice. I mean, a couple weeks ago, you did a cover review for the New York Times Book Review on a book about Raymond Carver.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that Dean Koontz or Peter Straub have done. I mean, is that by design for you?
Well, I was asked to review the piece. There was a biography of Raymond Carver by Carol Sklenecka, and at the same time, coincidentally or not, was a portable library of all Carver stories. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes think that I get asked to review certain books at the New York Times because I'm the resident expert on drunk writers or drunk rock musicians because I spent so many years, you know, drunk and stoned myself.
And you have, especially in On Writing, written about your recovery from alcoholism. Did you have any fears that if you let go of the drink and the drugs, you'd lose the muse?
No, I just wanted to drink. It was kind of hard to quit that. I wasn't really thinking about the muse or writing or anything like that. I was thinking to myself, geez, this is going to be really tough. But it finally just had to happen. It was that or everything was, I was going to lose everything else. So I got involved with the Standard programs. We don't talk about them at the level of press, radio, and film, so I don't talk about them here. But you know what I'm talking about, there's 12 steps and all that stuff. And if you're not in one of those programs yourself, you probably have a relative or a friend who is. So
we're going to have to try and race through a few here. This is about your own family. Really lovely question. I've always thought On Writing was a love letter to your wife as much as a memoir writing essay. Could you please say something about this bond and to what do you attribute its endurance? You've been married, what, 27 years?
Well, she's great, a lot longer than that. I think we've been married since 1971, so you know, 91, 2001. That's 38 years. And we just... Yeah, I mean, she's terrific. When we started out, we were just a couple of kids. I was working in a gas station, and she was working in a Dunkin' Donuts. And later, I taught school. When Carrie sold the first book, we were living in a trailer. We didn't have a phone. And the thing about Tabby, her name is Tabitha, but she was pre-witch. She was named before that, Bewitched Show. She was actually named after a ship, the Tabitha Brown, that her father served in World War II. The thing is, she never, ever said, give up this dream of being a writer. It was never a question. She always felt that that was what I was supposed to do. And so there was never any, I just love her like mad. That's all I can say. And she's a pretty good writer herself.
She's a novelist.
She's published
herself.
seven novels. She's a terrific writer herself and a good poet.
Does your wife Tabitha ever get jealous of your characters, i.e. C. McGee?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, should Dustin Pedroia play shortstop?
No. Dustin Pedroia should not play shortstop for the Red Sox because the shortstop position is cursed for the Red Sox. And he should stay at second base.
Do you think they'll get Roy Halladay?
Yeah, Roy Halladay would make a terrific addition to the Red Sox staff, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay.
Just as long as the f***ing Yankees don't get him.
Now that we've got the important stuff out of the way, are you planning to write anything appropriate for middle school age, such as Eyes of the Dragon? This is from Connie. She has fifth grade students who don't know who you are.
Yeah, well, I try as much as I can to write for everybody. And I think a lot of times I love it when students meet my work outside the classroom, outside the lines, because I think that's where real learning takes place. But, yeah.
What would your advice be to an aspiring young writer who's experiencing writer's block from fear of failure?
Well, you got to write. That's all. There's no other way to it. You're going to continue to fear failure until you just... Well, failure what? I mean, if you're doing the job, we're all amateurs. Nobody really knows what the hell we're doing here. And you go out and you do it and knock yourself out and have a great time. Remember, it's the playground. It's not anything to be afraid of. It's just... People might not like it, but screw them.
What are you afraid of, Stephen King? Anything?
What am I afraid of?
What are you scared of, Stephen King?
Oh, man, I don't know. It's everything. Really.
Okay, let's see. I'm 44 years old now, and when I was in high school, you were my favorite author. How has getting older impacted your own values and priorities?
Well, getting older sucks, kind of. But I don't think it's impacted them a lot. I think that mostly I'm the same guy I ever was. I'm sure everybody feels the same way. Inside, you feel like you're about 23.
All right, well, I'm indulging myself in my personal theory about you. that you do play on fear and death and fear of the unraveling of safety and the triumph of evil, at least for a little while. But I think your real sympathy is with the fragile, the vulnerable child, the beaten wife, the bullied, the scapegoated. And at their heart, your books are about love.
Well, you know what? I think good wins over evil, but I think the price is usually real high. And maybe that's the way it's supposed to be.
Was author Stephen King. I spoke with him as part of the Writers on a New England Stage series, a partnership of NHPR and the Portsmouth Music Hall. To hear the entire performance or to listen to other shows from the series, visit nhpr.org and click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. Broadcast producer for the program was Avishai Artsy. Rebroadcast producer is Rebecca Lavoie. Our live sound engineer was Eric Ruder. Recording engineer was Mike Marchand. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. You'll find a link to more on Stephen King, including reviews of his latest bestseller, 112263, at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. You're listening to New Hampshire Public Radio.